The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. And can you hear me all right? Everybody's good? Okay. One of the primary ways in which religious teachings are conveyed by religions is through the stories that they tell. And people tend to remember the stories and celebrate the stories of founders and different events of the religion. And Buddhism is no different in that it has stories that it tells that are meant to convey some of the teachings and some of our existential condition of our lives. And one of the great stories is the story of the last days of the Buddha's life. They say that in the history of Indian literature, there's one text called the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Sutta on the Buddha's final passing, which is an account of his last 6, 7, 8 months before he died. And it's the first, oldest record we have in India of something, anything like a biography of a person, anything kind of like an account of someone's life that unfolds. So it's kind of a new genre of the times. And what scholars have said is this account of the Buddha's last day was not done by a court reporter who was there to record everything down verbatim, but rather was something that was built and added to over the centuries. Because what religions do is they tend to come up with new stories. And they sometimes forget the new stories are invented, and they add them in, and they create a collection of wonderful stories that the religious tradition lives by. And so this text, this very large text called the Discourse on the Final Passing of the Buddha, is made up of many small pieces. And through it, you see how in the ancient world, what they thought was important to retain, an important way of teaching, what was an important message, what was an important way of remembering the Buddha. And what's one of the things that's interesting about this text is they kind of dramatically try to get it both ways. They both try to present the Buddha in very human terms, more than almost any other. There's a huge many volumes of ancient discourses, and the Buddha never quite seems human. He's human, but he's not depicted in having so many of his normal human emotions and things. He's very kind of independent and free, or equanimous in the middle of it all. This last text shows much more human and much more human situation, and interspersed with that is him being somewhat superhuman. And so, for example, he has to cross the Ganges River. And how do you cross the Ganges River if you're a great founder of religion? You fly over. So there was a variety of things, kind of a little bit more superhuman. What I'd like to do this evening is to tell you some of the more human side of what was written down. We don't know, again, if this really represents the Buddha. We don't know what represents the Buddha. We just know we have these stories. And what you're going to get today is a modern Buddhist choosing those stories, which I think are significant. And what I'm going to choose is those stories that depict him more as a human being. And if you tease apart some of the stories and kind of look behind, kind of in between the lines of some of the things that are being said, you get an account that the Buddha, in the end of his life, was living in a time of tremendous turmoil. The world that he knew for 80 years was in many ways falling apart. And here he is, falling apart himself as an 80-year-old man, sick and old. And you see kind of this whole situation, society and him facing a certain kind of transition for him, his sake, his death. And then how he composes himself, how he goes through that, what he thinks is important at that juncture in his life, and how he dies is part of his message. It's said in this Theravadan tradition that there are four heavenly messengers. These are considered kind of mythic ideas of what very auspicious things that you can see that inspires people in their practice, that inspires people about the importance of facing the existential issues of our life in order to kind of find our peace with them, our liberation with them. And these four heavenly messengers are sickness, old age, and death. And then the fourth one is a renunciant, someone who has found a way to live peacefully in the midst of this life of sickness, old age, and death. And in this discourse, last days of the Buddha is the heavenly messenger for all four. He's sick, you'll see. He's old. He dies. And he's a renunciant. And he's someone who has lived a life of peace, of liberation, of freedom. So, you know, the story kind of, you know, carries a lot. This ancient story conveys him as an old and sick and person in pain. Very different from the statues and images that survive. Buddhists down through the ages have mostly wanted to depict the Buddha as a relatively young person, radiant, fleshy, upright, straight back, nice smile. Probably this is a statue we have here is depicting him the night of his awakening. He's sitting in meditation. And it's said that he was about 36 at that time. So, you know, well, healthy looking, upright 36-year-old man, kind of looks good, right? And the statues, you know, some of the statues, he looks even younger. And it's very, very rare. I don't even actually know if there are statues of the Buddha as an old man. I guess people don't like to represent their founder, of their religion in, a decrepit old guy bent over. you want to have an image that represents your religion well. but you kind of get the wrong impression of life if that's all you see. You don't get the heavenly messengers of sickness, old age, and death in the same way. So before we get into the story in this text that I'm going to tell you, there's a context for it that a little bit interpretive, but I'll tell you what's the interpretation and what comes from the most ancient texts. There is a discourse where a king comes to see the Buddha. His name is Pasanadi, and he was contemporary to the Buddha. They were the same age. They're both 80 years old in the story. And the king learns that the Buddha is not so far away, within a day's trip from where he is. And so he gathers a few people together and goes out to this to see the Buddha. And this king was probably, of all the kings of that area, there were a number of small countries, this king was the one who was probably the best friends with the Buddha. They'd known each other seemingly most of their lives. And so they were friends, and Buddha regularly conferred with the king, or the king conferred with the Buddha and things. And here they are, two 80-year-old men. The king learns that the Buddha is nearby. He makes a trip to go see him. And then when he comes to the woods where the Buddha is, Buddha is living in some wooded area, the king has his minister with him, and maybe an army with him, small, personal army to protect him or something. But when you go see a Buddha, you go see a great religious figure, you usually don't carry with you your sword, your weapon, right? You take your AK machine gun and put it outside before you go into the church, right? Most people don't carry the machine guns with them. So the king took his sword and his turban. Both of those also were symbols of his power. And he took those off. And he gave them to his minister. He goes in to see the Buddha, and they have a chat, and the king says, "It's really great. We've known each other for a long time. You're an old man, you're 80 years old. I'm an old man, you're 80 years old." This is all taking place in the foothills of the Himalayas, right at the border between his country and where the Buddha was born, and the Buddha is back at his place, his home country. And that's kind of the end of the story. But what's between the lines and what the history elsewhere preserves, is that the minister, having the regalia of power, the symbols of power, left. Went back to the capital and left a horse and a servant to wait for the king to come out. He took the sword and the turban, went back to the capital, and gave those to the son of the king. And the son usurped the throne. So that's one story. He's 80 years old. He's up at the foothills of the Himalayas, the Buddha is. Next thing we know is that we have this discourse I'm going to tell you about called the Discourse of the Final Passing of the Buddha. The Buddha, it's the last 6, 7, 8 months of the Buddha's life. So he's 80 years old. And he's not anymore up there in his home country. He's at least 300 miles to the south, in a capital of a different country where there was a king named Ajatasatru, who had killed his father to become king many years earlier. So these were bad, bad sons back then. And so what is the Buddha doing? What is an 80-year-old man doing walking 300 miles across the plains of India? Why would someone who's 80 years old, maybe he was he really fit? Was he flying like across the river? Just that's the mystery. Why the distance? What the later literature says is that in terms of the king who was usurped, Pasenadi, remember, he was left in the woods without his sword and his turban. He couldn't go back to his capital because he had been usurped. All he had was himself, a horse, and a servant. And so he wanted maybe a shelter, a place to go for refuge. And this king, other king who'd killed his father, 300 miles to the south, he was kind of his uncle. They were kind of like related through marriage. And they had gone to war with each other some years earlier. And Pasenadi had beat the younger Ajatasattu, but he'd released him to go home. So he owed him a favor, right? So the king Pasenadi walked 300, or on his horse, 300 miles to go visit the other king for place of safety, to the place where we find the Buddha in this end of his life. And the story goes that the king, Pasenadi, who went for shelter, came at nighttime to the edge of the city walls. They wouldn't open the gate for him. He went to a guest house and died there. So this is the interpretation. The interpretation is the Buddha was friends with King Pasenadi. Things were up. Things were not looking good. And so he wanted to probably help his friend, the king. Maybe go down to the other, to 300 miles south to this king Ajatasattu and help Pasenadi out. But the king's on horse, the Buddha's on foot. And by the time the Buddha gets down there, the king is dead. So what we do know from these stories is the Buddha was in his home country at 80 years of age, walked 300 miles south, and then in this discourse I'm going to tell you about, it begins by him walking back north again. Why would an 80-year-old man walk all the way down 300 miles and start walking back up again? So the idea is that there's a war afoot. There's usurping afoot. And the king, the son who usurped the king in the woods, he didn't like the Buddha's homeland. And he became kind of an enemy of the Buddha's countrymen. So that was not good news. Maybe the Buddha was going for shelter too. So then this discourse of the Buddha's last days opens. He's in the capital of Ajatasattu before he's heading out north again. And Ajatasattu says, I want to go and attack my neighboring country called the Vijayans. And he says to a minister, go to the Buddha and ask him if this is a good idea. And hear what he has to say about it. So war is at foot, right? The king wants to attack a neighboring country. And the Buddha says, so the minister goes and says, the king wants to do this, you know. What do you think? And I think in the ancient world, this world, you know, the kings were kind of absolute power. And so you couldn't really kind of say directly to the king, I don't think that's a good idea, don't do it. So the Buddha says something indirect. Actually, he doesn't even, he turns to his attendant, Ananda, and he says, as long as the Vijayans hold regular and frequent assemblies, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. Ananda, have you heard that the Vijayans meet in harmony, break up in harmony, carry on their business in harmony? Ananda says, yes. So as long as they can live in harmony with each other, get along well, and meet regularly, they'll prosper, meaning no one can conquer them. That's what he's implying. And the minister gets that, understands that. Oh, yeah. I guess, you know, we're not going to succeed attacking them with our army. But then the minister, who's smart, says, Buddha, if the Vijayans really do follow these principles you're talking about, they can be expected to prosper, not decline. Certainly, Vijayans will never be conquered by King Ajatasattu by force of arms. Listen to this. But only by means of propaganda and setting them against one another. And now, Reverend Gotama, may I depart? I am busy and have much to do. I mean, the poor Buddha. Oh, he just was trying to prevent war. And he said, no, you can't beat these people by arms. And the king says, the minister says, yes, well, then I know what to do. We're going to go and set them against each other. We're going to go in there and subterfuge the whole society indirectly, not with arms, but in other ways. Was that kind of painful to hear? You know, it's kind of like the Buddha gave away the clue. The Buddha hadn't said anything. Maybe nothing would have, you know, they would have attacked and they wouldn't have won. But he gave them the key to what it would take. What a terrible way to story to begin. I could just feel the Buddha go, ouch. Oh no, what did I do? What did I say? So then the Buddha starts heading north. And on the way north, at some point he gets sick. The Buddha was attacked by severe sickness with sharp pains as if he were about to die. But he endured all this mindfully, clearly aware and without complaining. He thought, it is not fitting that I should attain final nibbana without addressing my followers and taking leave of the order of monks. Then, when the Buddha, having recovered from his sickness, as soon as he felt better, he went outside and sat on a prepared seat in front of his dwelling. Then the Venerable Ananda came to him, saluted him, sat down to one side and said, Lord, I have seen the Buddha in comfort, and I have seen the Buddha patient, enduring in pain. And my body was like a drunkard. Ananda is talking about himself. Ananda is Buddha's attendant. My body was like a drunkard, seeing the Buddha in pain. I lost my bearings, and things were unclear to me because of the Lord's sickness. The only thing that was some comfort to me was the thought, the Lord will not attain final liberation, death, until he has made some statement about the order of monks. It's kind of reasonable, right? An old guy, 80 years old, has an order of monks that he's created. You'd think he'd like to give his final teachings, something to him. And this is very interesting what he says. But Ananda, what does the order of monks expect of me? I have taught the Dhamma, the teaching, making no inner and outer, making nothing that was secret and public, nothing private and public, nothing just for the inner crowd and for the public crowd, making no inner and outer, that the Buddha has no teacher's fist in respect to teachings. Teacher's fist means you keep certain things hidden away so not everyone can know it. And if anyone And if there is anyone who thinks, I shall take charge of the order, or that the order shall refer to me, let him make some statement about the order, but the Tathagata does not think in such terms. So why should the Tathagata make a statement about the order? So he's basically saying, I'm not going to appoint anyone to be the successor. He doesn't want a successor. Later, in other places, it says, my successor is the teaching and the practice. And then then the Buddha goes on, very human. Ananda, I am now old, worn out, one who has traversed life's path. I have reached the term of life, which is 80. Just as an old cart is made to go by being held together with straps, so my body is kept going by being strapped up. It is only when I withdraw my attention from the outer world by meditation and enter into a deep meditative trance that my body knows comfort. It's quite something. This is before they had Tylenol. So only through meditation, deep meditation, could he be free of his pain. So he's just been sick. He's living in pain. There's another discourse somewhere where the Buddha describes himself as stooped over. Not very dignified for your great founder of your religion to be stooped over. An old man stooped over, bent back. So it's quite something. And then he gives a teaching. Let me back up a little bit. What I skipped over was, so he leaves the capital of this king who wants to attack the Vijayans. He comes to another capital, and there, they're building a fort. And fortifying their city. Because the Vijayans, remember, King Ajatasattu wants to attack the Vijayans. The Vijayans want to attack this other place. And this king up north has just usurped his father, and he wants to attack the Buddha's home country. War is afoot. The world is changing. The Buddha is sick and in pain. And at around the same time, the Buddha's two closest disciples die. Sariputta dies, which is his right-hand man, kind of his main disciple. So before the Buddha dies, his Dharma child dies, right? And then another disciple, his third most important disciple, and then Mahamoggallana dies. But he dies by being killed by bandits. Quite a story, huh? So this is quite a dramatic way of ending one's life. This is a man who, you know, we associate the Buddha with living peacefully, having kind of being at peace, you know, liberated, awakened, enlightened person. Certainly he must have been. But that's no guarantee that that preserves or saves us from any of us or from him, from the conditions of society and the world. And so he was living in this is the kind of world he was living in. So in that kind of context now, he's been sick, Ananda is upset, disturbed by how sick he was, he's old, he's in pain. He's going to give kind of important teachings at this point. So he says to Ananda, you know, I'm old, he says, in pain. Therefore, given all this, you should live as a light unto yourselves, being your own refuge, with no one else as your refuge, with the Dharma as a light, with the Dharma as your refuge, with no other refuge. So be a light on yourself. The society around you is no guarantee for your stability and your safety, your health and your body. But there is a light. There is a refuge you can have. And that refuge is found in yourself. And then he's going to say how you do that. And how does a monk live as a light unto himself or herself? Here, a person abides mindful of the body, earnest, clearly aware, mindful and having put away all hankerings and fretting for the world, and likewise in regard to feelings, mind, and mind objects. This is how a person lives as a light upon themselves. So what he's teaching here is the four foundations of mindfulness. That the practice of being mindful is something about being clearly attentive, aware in the present moment, centered and grounded in your own immediate experience, which gives you a light, gives you a refuge in the middle of this social and personal, you know, change and turmoil of of his times, and probably for our times as well. And then he walks north, and periodically he stops and teaches along his way, going north. And it takes him about 6 months to walk about 230 miles. And at one point he said, he's going to tell the monks what it is he discovered. And to me, this also seems pretty poignant. The Buddha taught for some 45 years and was a great teacher. And now he knows he's going to die, and he wants to tell the essence of what it was he discovered. So you kind of think, this is what you want to stop and listen to this. And this is what he says. This is what I discovered and proclaimed, and it should be thoroughly learnt by you, practiced, developed, and cultivated. So it's interesting, you have to learn it first, but then it's something you want to practice and cultivate. This is not just a creed to memorize and believe in. It's something to be practiced and developed inside of oneself. So that this holy life, this practice life, may endure for a long time, that it may be for the benefit and happiness of many, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit of everyone. It's a beautiful statement. Practice these things for the benefit of all. And what are those matters that I discovered? So, I'll read them to you, but I think some of you will fall asleep as I go through the list. So I'll explain to you first, but maybe you, so if you fall asleep, you'll know the point. What he lists here are a set of spiritual practices and states of mind or heart that arise out of doing those practices. When he says, this is what I discovered, he doesn't say a set of beliefs. He doesn't say this is the true nature of reality, the cosmos, but rather what he says is, I discovered a set of practices that you can do that help you become a light unto yourself, that help you become free, find your peace in the middle of your turmoil of your life. And so he goes through these different things that he discovered. The four foundations of mindfulness, the four right efforts, the four roads to power, the five spiritual faculties, the five mental powers, the seven factors of enlightenment, and the Noble Eightfold Path. So these are practices that we can do and states of mind and experiences we can have. And now, monks, I declare to you, all conditioned things are of a nature to decay. Strive on mindfully. Then he says to them, to his monks, my final passing will not be long delayed. Three months from now, I will take my final liberation. I will die. So he continues on his travels, going slowly north. And then he goes and is invited to a meal at house of a blacksmith. And the blacksmith offers him some food, including something that literally is translated as pig's delight. We don't know if it's pork or some kind of mushroom. We don't know what it is. But the Buddha said to people there, no one else should eat this. I don't think no one else is able to digest this food, but I'll eat it. After I eat my share, you should go bury the rest of it. Well, he eats it. And this is what happens. After having eaten the meal provided by the blacksmith, the Lord was attacked by a severe sickness with bloody diarrhea and with sharp pains if he was about to die. But he endured all this mindfully and clearly aware without complaint. Bloody diarrhea. Is that your Buddha? You know, that's not the image you get looking at these statues. Again, but he endured it without complaint. So then he goes on, is able to continue a little bit longer. And then as he gets closer and closer to death, they start asking him other kinds of questions like, what shall we do with your remains after you die? And the Buddha says, don't worry yourself, he's talking to his monks, don't worry yourself about the funeral arrangements. Instead, you should strive for the highest goal. Devote yourself to the highest goal and dwell with your minds tirelessly, zealously devoted to the highest goal. So to his monastics, don't worry about funeral arrangements. It's not important. What's important for you at this point is keep your practice going. Just, you know, forget about taking care of me after I die. Isn't that nice? he has one thing he wants to teach. You know, there was a very famous monk in Thailand named Buddhadasa, one of the great monks of the 20th century. And he lived in the woods most of the time. He had a big monastery, but very few built a little kind of wooden huts and stuff in the woods. And he lived most of the time outdoors. And he lived to be quite old. And his instructions was that when it was time for him to die, when he died, was to put his body up against a tree in the woods. And so the monks and nuns could watch him, the body decay. Just to kind of, watch the natural cycle take over. But he was so famous in Thailand that he wasn't given that chance. He didn't follow his instructions, and he got a big state cremation. So and then poor Ananda is his Buddha's cousin, who for 27 years was his attendant. And Ananda, is getting wind that the Buddha is going to die. His uncle is going to die. His cousin is going to die. And then Venerable Ananda went to his lodgings and stood lamenting, leaning on the doorpost. Alas, I'm still a learner with much to do, and the teacher is passing away who was so compassionate to me. So he's kind of, he's lamenting the passing of his cousin and his teacher. But the Buddha hears about this, and he calls Ananda and tells him, enough, Ananda, do not weep and wail. Have I not already told you that all things that are pleasant and delightful are changeable, subject to separation and becoming other? So how could it be, Ananda, since whatever is born, become, compounded, is subject to decay, how could it be that it should not pass away? It's probably not, usually if you counsel someone in America who's crying and loss of someone, you don't say, oh, everything's passing and that's the way it is. But there is some wisdom to it, to recognize that, to see that, to be with it. But this is what the Buddha wanted to tell his cousin. So then we're coming closer and closer to the end. And then the Buddha, we don't know why he was heading back north. The assumption has been he was heading back to go to his home country. It kind of makes some sense, right, that people when they're old and want to die, sometimes they want to go home. And so it seems like he'd done this 300-mile walk south, turned around, now he's walking back. And if that's the truth, that he was heading back home, he didn't make it. So another part of this, things are falling apart, society's changing, he's sick, he's in pain, he has a wish maybe to go home, but even that wish cannot be fulfilled because he's, coming so close to the end. So then he comes to a small village, and he tells his attendants to arrange a bed for him underneath two trees outdoors. And there he lays down. And there there he spends his last night, and he dies during that night. And there, one of his last, I think, kind of touching things that he does is he asks the monks, his monastics who are around him, he asks them three times. He says, it may be that some monks have doubts or uncertainty about the Buddha, the Dharma, or the Sangha, or about the path or the practice. Ask now. Do not afterwards feel remorse, thinking, the teacher was there before us and we failed to ask the Buddha face to face. That's pretty nice, you know. Yeah, I'm going to give you one chance, one last chance to really ask your questions. Look deeply. Do you have any doubts, any concerns? This is your chance. It's like one of the very last things he does while he's still alive. And he asks three times, and no one has any questions. No one asks him. And then the Buddha says what he said earlier. All conditioned, this is the very last thing he said, and different translators will translate differently. It's a very significant statement. All conditioned things are of a nature to decay. Strive on untiringly, or diligently be mindful. The last thing he said, be mindful, diligently. And then, laying there underneath these two trees at night, he entered into his states of meditation. And he went into the deepest states of meditation that he knew. And then he started to come out of the deepest states of meditation, came kind of almost all the way out. And then he went about halfway down to the depths that he knew. And halfway down to the depths of meditation that he was familiar with from many years of meditating, that's where he passed away. It's a great, you know, you can imagine the monks sitting there underneath two trees, the nighttime in the plains of India. He seems to, you know, he's offered his monks the chance to ask questions. He's given his last teachings. He seems pretty much at peace with things not going well around him. The world's coming up, falling apart with war and violence and death of his disciples and his old age. But he seems peaceful. And then, because you cannot go deep into these states of meditation if your heart's not at rest, if you're not at peace. It's not possible. You have to be pretty quiet and settled. And he dips deep in. Goes in, goes deep, comes out, begins to go in deep again, and then he passes away peacefully. Isn't that a beautiful way of dying? So that's the human side of the story. I left out the jumping over the river, flying over the river. But this, because I tell it this way, because this human side of the story is what I find most meaningful and inspiring, that, you know, we all, hopefully, if we're lucky enough, I suppose, all of us will have to encounter these things, sickness, old age, and death. All of us might, like the typhoon in the Philippines, you know, we live on top of the San Andreas Fault, you know. Tomorrow, the news might be about us, not the Philippines. You know, we don't know. We're not expecting war in California anytime soon. Nevada is not about to attack us. But you know, the society can be turned upside down very quickly, and your health can change quickly. And to remember this, and to take it in, and not to be depressed or discouraged or frightened or despair around it. But there's a way, what the Buddhist tradition says, there's a way of taking this very seriously and honestly that can be, I don't know if inspiring is the right word, but motivating to practice, motivating to really get down to what's most important in life, at least what the Buddhist tradition says is, And that is, in a sense, to get to the other side of those things. Get in the sense of getting the other side of sickness and old age and death, the other side of war and social turmoil, so that as they're happening, we are not pushed around by them. We're not caught by it. We don't despair by them. We found our peace with them, our freedom in the midst of it. And this beautiful thing he said earlier, that certainly practice for this, cultivate these things for, out of compassion for the world, for welfare and happiness of all beings. So that's how the founder of this religion died. And I think it's a nice story. If you go into the library, I think it's still there, on the very top shelf in the library, there's a statue of the Buddha passing away. We let him pass away in the library. He's up, it's about four feet long statue. He's laying down on one side. So if you go in there, you can pay your respects. So I hope that was okay to tell you these ancient stories and share this with you, to get a sense a little bit of what the ancient Buddhist tradition, or not just the ancient, but what this, the religious side of Buddhism that relies on stories and texts, you know, where it all comes from. This is part of it. And for those of you who couldn't care less about stories and prefer to have just the basic technology of mindfulness and helping you cope better in your life, that'll come some other night. So thank you.